In a rich country like the U.S., tariff revenue is 3-3.5% of total government revenue, whereas on average for low-income countries, it's about 18%.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. While in advanced economies, many tariffs and other barriers to trade have been torn down, among developing countries, they're still around. There's a huge potential to drive growth from trade if they could be removed. So why are they still there? David Atkin of MIT and Amit Khandelwal of Columbia Business School have been reviewing what we know about how trade works in developing countries and the surprising gaps that still exist in our knowledge. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. David, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello.
And Amit, welcome as well.
Hello.
David, first of all, here's the big question. How important is international trade for development?
Excellent question. So, you know, our view is that international trade really is critical for the development process. And, you know, that view is predicated on the fact that pretty much all of the successful transitions we've seen from low-income countries to high or middle-income countries over the past century have been accompanied by a large increase in trade and foreign direct investment. And, you know, we think that this opportunity to be able to access international markets has been key to raising the productivity of firms in developing countries, in part by exposing them to world-beating competition that you need in order to export successfully, and also through knowledge transfers that occur as part of the sort of trading process as you're sort of trading with sort of sophisticated foreign buyers. But, you know, all of that said, we don't have a lot of convincing evidence, at least big picture evidence, on how critical trade is for development. It's a very difficult question to answer. And that's because when we do observe developing countries sort of pivoting towards being much more open to trade, they often do so at the same time as changing many other policies. So, for example, a reformist government comes in, and not only do they open up to trade, but they also reform a lot of domestic sectors, change tax laws, put in a lot of new programs. And so it's very hard to actually causally discern the impacts of trade on the development process. Perhaps the best work we have trying to answer this does trade cause growth type of question uses variation generated by the arrival of the airplane. This is Jim Fira's work, where increasing use of cargo airplanes effectively changed how far apart some countries were, but didn't change how far apart other countries were. So, for example, if I'm shipping between Germany and China, then, you know, that sea route is very circuitous. Meanwhile, the air route is direct. And so we saw a big relative change in how far away those two countries are when you started shipping stuff by air cargo. And that simply wasn't the case for, say, shipments from the west coast of the US to China, where they were able to go straight across the sea or fly straight across. And so, you know, while obviously everyone benefited from lower trade costs, particularly countries like Germany, which previously had to take circuitous boat routes, gained even more. And so using that type of variation, we've been able to discern that indeed trade does have a large impact on growth, substantially increasing GDP growth rates. And the sort of similar analysis can be done with the closing and reopening of the Suez Canal, which differentially affected certain countries more than others, and we see how their growth responded. But beyond those two papers, and that maybe a couple of more, we don't really have a really good handle on this. But, you know, that said, you know, in our paper, we have something very direct to say about how important the policymakers in different countries perceive trade policy to be. And there we actually have some novel analysis.
We were interested in thinking about how policymakers perceive trade policy. And that's a kind of a difficult thing to address because there's no data on what policymakers are actually saying, or it's actually very difficult to come by that data. But we discovered that there's two relevant sets of documents that we think are quite interesting and could give us some insight into what policymakers are emphasizing and thinking about economic policies across countries. So the first set of documents are the Article 4 consultations that are issued annually by each member country of the IMF. One thing that's nice about these sets of documents is that they're standardized in their formats. All member countries, which is essentially all countries in the world, so they span the global income distributions, are part of the IMF. And because it's the IMF, these reports discuss very specific policies. And the types of policies that the IMF is interested in is thinking about exchange rates, balance of payments, fiscal policy, monetary policy, inflation, and trade policy. And so if you just do a textual analysis looking for the frequency of trade policies in their recent Article 4 consultations,
we do see evidence that the relative frequency of trade policy type words, these would be trade barriers, exports and imports, those are mentioned more frequently in developing countries. And then to go a bit further, there's another set of documents issued by the World Trade Organization where they talk specifically about different types of trade barriers. So trade barriers can come in the form of what we consider traditional trade barriers, things like tariffs and quotas. They can also come in the form of non-traditional trade barriers, things like intellectual property rights, phytosanitary restrictions, customs facilitations, and so forth. If you look inside these WTO trade policy reports, what you again find is that developing countries have a much broader emphasis on traditional trade instruments, things like tariffs and quotas, as opposed to non-tariff barriers such as rules of origins, customs, and logistics. And this seems to suggest that, again, you know, taking these two pieces of evidence together, the IMF report suggests that developing countries are more interested in trade policy as opposed to other broader forms of economic policy. And within trade policy, they're particularly focused on traditional trade barriers like tariffs and quotas.
How much higher are these trade barriers than they are in advanced economies?
That's a good question. So as I mentioned, trade barriers can be quantified in many ways. And because there's something like a rules of origin, which determines where a product originates from, is actually very difficult to quantify. So the easiest thing that we can quantify are tariff barriers. And if you just look at the average tariffs in upper income countries, as opposed to lower income countries, in upper income countries in 2018, tariff barriers were about 4.5%, according to the World Bank. And lower income countries had tariffs that were about 12%. So just using that particular measure alone, it suggests that low-income countries have 2.5 times higher tariff rate than developed countries. And there's many reasons for why that could be the case. Historically, developing countries have been allowed to keep trade barriers high when they enter the World Trade Organization. This was always some concern that there would be a domestic industry disruption if they lower their tariff barriers. There's always also a belief that infant industry type protections, in which nascent industries in a developing country may be able to grow if they're protected at their early stages, may be more relevant for developing countries. But it's also the case that tariffs as a form of revenue are much more important in low-income countries. It's just much easier for these countries, which generally have weak institutions, to collect taxes at the border as opposed to enforcing property or income taxes. So if you look at the World Bank's numbers, in a rich country like the U.S., tariff revenue is 3.5% of total government revenue, whereas on average for low-income countries, it's about 18%.
You argue in this paper that the way we tend to think about trade policy is often derived from neoclassical models that emphasize perfect competition, which may suit some advanced economies where these barriers and distortions have been negotiated away. But it doesn't really sound like the developing economies that you're describing.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, the standard models, as you emphasized, are typically perfect competition or have a very stylized form of imperfect competition. And certainly there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that's far from a good representation of many developing countries where we have, you know, anecdotes of very large, powerful conglomerates, which may be close to political leaders or large family businesses that may have a lot of monopoly power. In general, there's very poor antitrust enforcement, if they even have laws and regulations on it, in developing countries. And so certainly, you know, as a benchmark, it may be useful when thinking about the impacts of trade in developing countries to be thinking about a setting where there is a heavy degree of imperfect competition, large monopolies and such like. In terms of how that might impact the effects of trade, there things are a little bit ambiguous. While in general, we think that distortions are good, and particularly these types of distortions where these big firms are sort of producing less than we would like them to because they're attempting to raise the prices by restricting supply, we think that's typically a bad thing. But, you know, the presence of monopoly or very large firms may actually be a plus when it comes to trading relationships, insofar as we think there are very large fixed costs associated with entering into trading relationships and exporting to foreign countries. And it's possible that by, you know, having this monopoly power, these firms are able to sort of grow larger than they would and be able to pay those fixed costs and be better able to trade. The flip side is we think that if without a lot of competition, we think productivity might be quite low, and that might limit the ability of these firms to thrive in export markets and also lead to harm when imports do come in, when the domestic firms are not very able to compete with the foreign products.
Now, you look empirically across a lot of research in this paper and on three sets of barriers to trade. That's weak institutions, market failures, and distortions. Are these factors common barriers to trade across all developing countries?
Yeah, we think that these are three key distinguishing features of developing countries. So I guess when David and I think about what makes a developing country developing, we think about these three aspects: countries that have weak institutions, particular markets, either labor, capital, or different sets of markets may not be working perfectly, and there may be other forms of distortions in their economy. The important thing that we wanted to think about in writing the review was to take the perspective that most of the kind of standard models in international trade that we think about when we think, you know, what is trade going to do for an economy, they don't have these particular features. They're almost frictionless environments, which are probably better characteristics of developed countries. And so what we really wanted to do in this paper is to think through how these three aspects of developing countries, which I think many economists would agree are key aspects of developing countries, interact with or could interact with country opening up to trade barriers.
So let's have a look at this in more detail. Institutions, first of all. When we're talking about weak institutions with reference to trade, is this just a lack of enforcement of regulations, or is it more complicated than that?
So we think it's a bit more than that. So we wanted to think about weak institutions in four particular ways. So we wanted to think about the actual enforcement of a tariff regime. If you think about what a country does is when they implement tariffs, is there's a line on a piece of paper that says this particular product comes in at 7% and this particular product comes in at 12%. And then they turn it over to their customs officials to enforce that. And in a country with weak institutions, there's some evidence that the enforcement of the tariff regime may not be as accorded to it in the rules and regulations of the country. And that creates a couple of issues. First, if the country is using trade policy as a form of industry protection, then the lack of enforcement of trade barriers means that the policy is actually not being implemented. It also means that some companies may be better able to circumvent the tariffs as opposed to others, which lead to other, you know, firm-specific distortions in the economy, where some firms that are able to import or export are not able to do so because they're the most efficient producers, but because they're actually the best at being able to sidestep these regulations. So we wanted to look at what is the impact of tariff evasion on developing countries and to review those sets of papers. Contracting is another form of institutions, and contracts are critical for every aspect of an international trade deal. You can think about it as from the inception of an idea, you want to make sure that that idea is protected in your firm and it doesn't escape to other firms. Once you have that idea and the idea is actually produced, you're able to find a buyer and send that buyer the product and hope that you're able to receive payment for that. Now, if contracts are not actually being enforced, firms may not be able to use the legal system to enforce contracts. And what that means is that they need to find potential partners for which they have strong relationships with. For example, people who've done business in China will talk extensively about Guangxi. And Guangxi means that if you're a foreign multinational and you want to go into China and find a potential supplier, typically if that supplier was in, say, Germany, you might just figure out where you want to set arbitration in, you know, either in Germany or in the US or maybe in Switzerland or Sweden. And you sign the contract and you don't really need to know each other. You could do everything virtually almost. But I think in developing countries where contracts are not necessarily enforced completely, you will only do business with people you trust. So that means that trust can be a form of contract, but it also then means that it's a different kind of environment that you're in. The firms need to build that trust. We don't have great evidence, although there's an exciting area of literature now in economics studying this, where that trust or how that trust emerges. But it's certainly something that's going to affect trade in developing countries, we think, more than trade in developed countries.
Yes, talking about how that trust emerges, because we instinctively think of how institutions create opportunities to trade if we have strong institutions. Is there also evidence that trade can help build these institutions?
I think the answer to that is we think so. It's an area which is a fascinating area of study, and there's actually been probably less work than I think there should have been thinking about these topics. But the evidence we do have is somewhat compelling. So, for example, there's some work by Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson who argue that the Atlantic trade in the 17th and 18th centuries, just the impacts of that were way too large to possibly be caused just from increasing trading opportunities. And they argue that instead, part of the gains came from strengthening the merchant class, and at least in countries which already placed some constraints on the monarchy, the increased political power of the merchant class brought about improvements in property rights, which facilitated future growth. So that's sort of a direct link there between trade strengthening people who are pushing for more property rights, and the property rights raise growth. And then there's some sort of direct evidence for that story from Sumitra Jha, who looks at British parliamentarians who own shares in these overseas joint stock companies like the East India Company, and show that, you know, owning stock in those companies economies led you to push for more constraints on the executive in parliament. And so that's a kind of another example of that, where, you know, these trading opportunities led to institutional changes. And similarly, there's a little bit of work from Puga and Treffler, who look at Venetian trading opportunities much earlier in the 10th to 12th centuries, and showed that the sort of broad-based merchant class that rose thanks to these trading opportunities also pushed for these constraints on the executive and better contracting institutions, showing that link once again. But as I said, this is an area where the gains may swamp the standard gains we think of from trade, if trade's able to change institutions. And so I think there's room for much more work here.
Well, one thing I'll add on that is there was a very active debate when China was thinking about acceding into the World Trade Organization. The reformers wanted to accede into the World Trade Organization, and there was a guard that thought it was moving the country towards too much of a capitalist system. And one of the arguments that the reformers thought was that if we externally commit ourselves to these trade agreements, that will be a force that sort of permeates throughout other aspects of how business and how regulations and the economy is structured within China. And so that's an example where it's an anecdotal evidence, but I think one of the things that we discuss in this paper is that we need to understand those kinds of big picture questions better in terms of understanding how access to export markets or participation in global trade regimes may change institutions, either for better or for worse.
One important aspect of developing economies tends to be that there are significant labor market frictions. Is the evidence that these frictions are stopping firms from taking advantage of the trade opportunities that they have?
Yeah, so it's worth stepping back and thinking, imagine a country signs a free trade agreement with another country, and so it's now able to either import more products from that country or export products to that country. Suppose it wants to export products to that country. We would think that firms need to expand. And that's sort of one of the big benefits of trade, is that you get access to this larger market that you can now sell your stuff to. Now, if you want to do that, you need to expand not only the capital you have, but also the labor you have. And so if there are frictions within countries that prevent the movement of people, and a very important friction that people have studied is the China's Hukou system, which did impede the movements of migrants across the countries, then that's going to be a friction that an export-oriented company is going to face in terms of accessing labor. It can also go in the other direction. So in some countries, there's a benefit of staying small and having a small workforce, in the sense that once you become larger, you may be considered a formal firm and move into the formal economy and have to start paying additional corporate taxes or payroll taxes. And in that case, then firms may actively choose not to engage in export markets, because in order to do so, they need to become larger, but there's a very big cost of becoming larger. The fact that we see that there are large informal sectors in developing countries may be a manifestation of this. So we do think that, again, this is something that we don't have very systematic evidence on. Our view is that labor market frictions are likely to be more important in developing countries, either explicit movements of people within a country or people not being able to move because if they move, they lose their social insurance that they have within their own community. Those might be particularly salient and therefore may impede some firms from taking access to international trade because they're simply not able to access the workers.
Now, we dealt with labor. Let's also look at capital. In developing emerging economies, this was always scarce. It's even scarcer now as a result of the COVID-19 crisis. What is the impact that we see on trade growth from the scarcity of capital?
That's an excellent question. So actually, we know surprisingly little about the sort of causal impacts of trade financing on trade or generally finance on trade. But what we do know suggests that certainly trade is not going to benefit from limited capital. And that's for two reasons. The first is that if I'm in a trading relationship, particularly international trading relationship, then it may be many months or even years between me having to buy the inputs that I require to produce before I ship them off to the foreign country and to the buyer there, and they sell them, and then I get payment for them. And so, you know, capital is working capital is needed in order to sort of lubricate trade so that I can produce without yet being paid. And you know, obviously, with international trade, those gaps in time are longer. So it's particularly important. The second reason why trade financing is very important is we think that there are substantial fixed costs of exporting initially. So in order to start an exporting relationship, I first have to find a suitable buyer. I may have to get some certificate or show some tests on my products to show that they're suitable or adjust their design or their functionality. And then I need to navigate the customs process, maybe set up a local subsidiary in the destination market or advertising there. And so these initial costs of breaking into foreign markets might be quite large. And those, of course, will require financing for many companies. And so for both of these reasons, finance is very important for trade. But in terms of actually a sort of causal evidence of how trade credit affect trade flows, we have fairly little. What we do know is, for example, when there was a large credit supply shock in Peru during the 2008 global crisis, basis, Daniel Parisfini and others have shown that we can compare the firms who were essentially getting credit from a bank that ran into trouble versus firms who were getting financing from banks that didn't run into so much trouble, and show that the ones who had this kind of negative shock to the banks that they were using did indeed reduce their exports to their existing clients, sort of consistent with trade finance being a vital lubricant in the trading system. And so you would expect, as banks are more reluctant to lend and have stricter terms and are more risk averse, that we will indeed expect a reduction in trade flows.
Now, there are many distortions we could look at, but a particularly interesting one is the impact of political connections and lobbying. What do we know about the impact of this in developing countries?
We actually don't know very much. I think there's some open questions. We don't know if, in fact, the importance of political connections is stronger in developing countries than developed countries. We don't have a great sense of how it interacts with international trade. And so this is actually one part of the paper where we think that there's some very interesting research potentially to be done, because there's certainly anecdotes in some countries, for instance, where during a period of relatively high restrictiveness, I'll take the country of Myanmar, for example, the country that gave out export licenses to some particular firm. Who are those firms that got access to those licenses? You know, we think that political connections may have been involved, although we don't know for sure. Why might those particular firms have gotten those licenses? How would it affect the trade regime? Were they the ones that were really the most efficient firms to begin with? I think these are all really important questions. And again, we think it matters. And going back to markets with weak institutions and perhaps the ability to enforce deals between governments and firms. But I would say that we don't really have a great understanding of this, of how political connections and lobbying really play a role with respect to international trade in developing countries.
Now, this paper is a very thorough examination of what we do know. I'm going to ask both of you to speculate now. We are entering what people commonly consider to be a time of deglobalization. And of course, that's going to have a huge effect on developing economies. Do you think this is going to be an incentive for low-income countries to lower these trade barriers that we've been talking about?
I'll give the on the one hand, on the other hand response. So there's certainly a lot of discussion right now about the resiliency of supply chains. And so if I'm a U.S. multinational and I'm worried about future shocks, not just pandemics, but also what we saw with the Fukushima nuclear disaster a few years ago and how that disrupted supply chains as well. If we think that these kinds of shocks, particularly climate type shocks, are going to be more prevalent in the future, the firm may choose to bring many of its components closer to home. And so I would say that that may be a force towards limiting globalization in those developing countries. But there's, I think, at least two important policy trends that are pushing back against that. One would be the fact that, you know, the U.S.-China trade war is still ongoing and is likely to be in a period of, I would say, heightened conflict over the next several years. Some countries may benefit from that. In particular, Vietnam, we can see from early parts of the data, seems to be a country that did benefit from the trade war as companies started to look for new suppliers in Vietnam in order to avoid paying tariffs when they import from China. The second major force that's happening, which is likely to be a much more long-term force, is China's One Belt, One Road initiative, which is connecting a large swath of the developing world with each other. And so I think one thing that is likely going forward is a lot more trade amongst developing countries, perhaps on the Belt Road Initiative investment boom. But it's not just the Belt Road Initiative, but many countries themselves are building out deep water ports, investing in airports, investing in roads. And that's going to be just a general, David used this word lubricant when thinking about trade capital, but this is going to be a general lubricant to more trade within developing countries.
David, and last word to you.
One thing I'd add to that is another force which may actually work in the other direction, which is there's an increasing movement, particularly among Western nations, to limit immigration. Obviously, we've seen this in Europe with Brexit, and in the US, Trump just limited H-1B high-skill visas into the US for the rest of the year. And, you know, these types of movements may well lead to more globalization in the sense that previously, countries like the US and the UK attracted many high-skill immigrants from around the world who would do the work in these Western countries. Meanwhile, if that opportunity is blocked, then it's quite possible that many of these large companies that are hiring these types of workers will have to set up affiliates where many of the sort of skilled laborers are based in places like India and China. And then we may actually see an increase in globalization, given the fact that movements of workers and movements of goods are in some sense substitutes for each other, you know, potentially. And that may be a countervailing force in the coming years.
Very thorough, David and Amit. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I was going to say that the paper is everything that you need to know about trade and development, but I think I'm going to have to say it's everything you need to know about trade and development, provided it is known, bearing in mind David and Amit's warnings. But read it anyway. It is fascinating. It is extremely comprehensive, and it's very clear. The title is How Distortions Alter the Impacts of International Trade in Developing Countries, and the authors, obviously David Atkin and Amit Khandelwal. It is NBER Working Paper 26230. So it's both a summary and, of course, if you want further reading, then it's a great source of that as well. Very briefly, both of you, having read almost everything there is to read about this, where do you think the most interesting new research is going to be in this subject?
Well, David and I ran a conference at the Yale Growth Center, organized with Rohini Pandey, who's the director of the Growth Center, and Penny Goldberg, who was just returning to Yale from her position at the chief economist's office at the World Bank. And we explicitly targeted that conference towards juniors, so young scholars who are working at kind of at the intersection of trade and development. Historically, I think one of the things that we try to do in this paper is argue that they're kind of two separate areas, development economics research and international trade research, but the intersection is quite interesting. And I would say that there's a very nice cohort of very young and promising scholars who are using a variety of methods that range from your typical looking for a policy shock and the causal impacts of that policy shock to using structural methods that incorporate what we call general equilibrium forces or even running randomized controlled trials. And so it's an area where there's a variety of methods being used, and it's also got very young and active scholars in this area. So I would look for research coming out of this group.
I would say that three particular areas which came up in that conference as blind spots where more research is needed would be this topic of does trade affect institutions that we talked about in some detail, where I think more work would be useful. Trade finance is another area, and maybe I'll make a plug for just understanding imperfect competition in developing countries, how substantial it is and potentially how harmful it is both to trade and more generally. That's an area where there's been almost no work in developing countries and is a real sort of shortcoming, I think, in us understanding the development process.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you've enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform. You'll never miss an episode, or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.